As Kurt Austin finished his business at the Gant Estate, Paul and Gamay Trout were ending a similar attempt to reason with Tristan Margrave at his island hideaway in Maine. Like Austin, they'd met with denials and were turned out. From the top of the cliff, Margrave watched the Trouts motor away from the island. Then he undid the cell phone clipped to his belt and activated the voice dialing with a single word, Gant. Jordan Gant answered immediately. "I just got a visit from some Numa people," Margrave said. "They know a lot about the project."
"What a coincidence," Gant said. "A short while ago, I was paid a visit by Kurt Austin, also of Numa. He also seemed well-versed in our plans as well."
"The people who came here said that what we're doing could trigger worldwide destruction."
Gant laughed. "You've been on that island for too long. When you spend some time in a snake pit like Washington, you learn that the truth is exactly what you want it to be. They're bluffing."
"What should we do?"
"For a start, we can speed up the deadline.
I'll take my boat to Portland and catch a helicopter to Boston for the trip to Rio."
"Good. I'll join you there as soon as I take care of some minor matters."
In the Numa boardroom, Austin sat at an oak table and thought about Churchill's War Room, or the Oval Office, where decisions were made that affected the future of the world. He had no infantry divisions or powerful fleets, he mused. He had Joe Zavala, who would much rather be driving his Corvette convertible with a lovely woman at his side. Barrett, a brilliant computer nerd with a spider tattooed on his bald pate, and the beautiful and intelligent Carla Janus, who Austin would have preferred to be talking to over cocktails. His meager fighting force was looking unusually somber. They had just watched Trout's computer simulation showing the impact of a polar shift. The Trouts had called in earlier with their report. Austin hadn't been surprised at Margrave's reaction, nor at his own failure to persuade Gant to cancel his plans. "Paul and Gamay are on their way back from Maine," he announced. "They hit a dead end trying to persuade Margrave to call off his plans." He turned to Zavala.
"What have you got, Joe?"
"Good news. I asked Hiram Yeager to scour the records of shipbuilders." Yeager was Numa's top computer nerd. "I thought if we could figure out where the transmitter ships were built, we might be able to track them down. But even his supercomputer Max drew a blank. Next, I went after the dynamos. I thought they might be commercially made. I followed up on every one, checking their sales for the past 3 years. They all went to U.S. power companies, except one order supposedly shipped to a factory in South America, which is owned by Gant's foundation. The same multinational company that owns the factory has a shipyard in Mississippi. Then I accessed the Numa satellite archives. 4 ships left the boatyard last week. 3 transmitter ships and what looks like a passenger liner. They seem to be headed towards South America."
Barrett had been silent since watching the computer simulation.
"Thanks for your hard work, Joe. I'm feeling guilty as hell about all this. I can't stop thinking that this tragedy is my fault."
"Not at all," Carla said. "You could never know that your work would be used in a destructive way. It's no different than my grandfather. He was simply interested in pure science."
"Maybe that's where we should be looking," Austin said. "The Kovacs theorems. Can you remember anything that might shed light on how we can deal with polar shift?"
Carla was shaking her head when a smile appeared on her face.
"Topsy-turvy."
She laughed at the bewildered expressions around the table.
"It's the title of a bedtime poem my grandfather used to tell me. Not very good poetry, as I recall, but he said it was something that I would always have if I needed it."
She scrunched her brow as she tried to remember the words.
"Topsy-turvy, turvy-topsy. The world stands on its head. The sky's on fire, the earth's afraid, the ocean leaves its bed."